Hi, Calvin.
Hi, Ode.
We're doing a session of recordings, a series of recording sessions in which we talk about what you've been finding with Tetrionics. And I've asked you if every now and then I can spring a question on you, which I'm not going to explain to you beforehand, but just put in front of you, basically with the hope that everybody can see that you actually know this stuff. You don't have to prepare for it, but also the knowledge that you have is so connected that you are able to understand the questions and the implications and are able to resolve them. So basically to show that Tetrionics is a tool and a technique rather than a knowledge or a myth. And for today, for now, I would like to put a question on the table, which essentially continues on what you have already described about atoms. We talked about the atom structure, and we talked about the, say, the radiative part of atoms, say the static and the dynamic part of atoms. And today, I'd like to open that up in a larger perspective, because of course we know that there's a universe, we know there's atoms, and sometimes it seems that as if in science the two are different, and in tetrionics that is not. You understand how the tetrions create the universe, how you've written the handbooks. You're still working on more of that, and you realize that with the tetrion as the basis, you could understand and describe quantum theory, all of the electrodynamics, all of the molecular atomic organizations, even up to the level of biology and the cosmos. And for now, I'd like to present you the question of, as a main question, how, from your perspective, would you think about the concept of the tetrion universe? And then there's four parts which I sort of, in my mind, would like to propose as stepping stones so that others can follow how it unfolds. Because everybody can go to the website and find your templates, they can cut them out, put them on the table, and understand with tetrion. So the first starting point would be for me tetrions. The next part in my mind would be what in physics is called the duality between fermions and bosons. Those, for the people who are not into that fundamental level of physics, that's basically the duality from which all particle formations could be considered to be starting. Then, after that, at the third level, how do the fermions and bosons together create the tetrionic atoms? You've already explained that separately. But I think it would be a good intermediate step to then go on to the understanding at the fourth level of the question of tetrionic materials, both organic and inorganic, and essentially painting the foundation of the tetrion universe. How do you like the
Sure.
question? Will that work for you?
That'll work. I'll actually rearrange the second question, fermions and bosons, to go before tetrions themselves, because we're really discussing mass, energy, and matter, and the mass comes before, or two-dimensional mass energies come before the formation of three-dimensional matter. So it's probably better to swap those two around so that we can do this exploration from the ground up, so to speak, starting with the smallest Planck quanta and trying to paint a picture of how it all comes together and interacts to give us the universe that we see now without all the complicated explanations that normally accompany all that. Because at the moment, everyone's familiar with all the massive amounts of complex formulas and mathematical equations relating to chemistry or to quantum mechanics or to electricity or to gravity, but nobody sees what's actually creating all these different formulas. And they, because they don't see this underlying geometry, you can't find the unified field equation that shows where all this math comes from. the mathematics is simply just our way of trying to describe what we see and what we measure. Mm. Whereas tetrionics, with its definitions of mass and matter and energy, geometries, allows us to physically build a two- and three-dimensional model of interactions that give us mass, energy, and matter, and gives us the physics that we then turn into mathematics. So if we do it from the ground up, from Planck quanta, zero-point fields, as they're sometimes termed, and build it up from there on in, hopefully we'll have a fairly clear picture.
Yeah, Calvin, within the short time frame. Does this require, right at the start, a bit more of an explanation for some on this difference in dimension? Because in physics, evidently, a lot of people do not know of the difference between matter, mass, and energy. They do not realize or appreciate that they are in different dimensions. And as a result, in me, this question comes up of, well, would it be a good idea to briefly have your view on those different dimensions in place, that people can think along from that perspective? Because so often people do not talk about that. As a result, they will not put those spectacles on their nose and will not see the in-depth differences.
For sure. And I think it's important that we probably do start from there. Perhaps do this first discussion purely on space, spatial coordinates, mm-hmm. and how mass and matter fill those spatial coordinates differently. Because everyone these days is taught about curved space-time. Nobody, including the physicists and the mathematicians, differentiate between mass and matter. And it's such a fundamental part of physics, as explained in tetrionics, and that is what opens up the door to understanding how everything works with a mind, a model in your head or on the made out of pieces of paper on the desk. Mm. It gives you that model by understanding mass and matter and how it relates to space and the dimensionality of it all. Well, sweep aside a lot of the confusion, and in fact you'll probably end up sitting there shaking your head when you hear highly educated physicists talking about the mass of the sun is what creates its gravity. Well, it's not. Mm-hmm. It's the matter of the sun that creates the gravity, and the amount of mass in the matter creates the weight that we measure. So a lot of subtle little things, and they're so hopelessly mixed up in physics today that I think it'd be well worth going into detail just on the basic concepts of what is space and spatial coordinates that we measure things in.
Okay.
And how does energy in all its forms create mass, energy, and matter in that spatial region or in spatial regions?
Yeah.
It's actually the first chapter.
Okay, so you suggest that we basically do a separate session on that. And you, in a way, already implied that, referred to that, when we were talking about the difference between longitudinal and transverse waves. Again, that understanding that if you look at the way the energy fills out the space, you actually need to understand those differences in relationship, because otherwise you cannot understand why the processes and the principles work differently.
Why we get different results and where these results come from. Because in essence, every electromagnetic wave is just a triangle of energy. But it's the direction that triangle is orientated as it moves towards yourself or the measuring device that determines its properties, determines how much momentum you feel, determines how much heat you feel, or what it can do as it interacts with other forms of matter. And even though everything, and literally everything in the universe is made up of equilateral energies, the way these energies come together produces a huge range of interactions, which we call physics. And that includes chemistry, it includes gravity, cosmology, it even extends further up into the biological processes, as in what is life, how does DNA code for things, and what is consciousness? Because equilateral Planck quanta are the building blocks of mass, energy, and momentum in the universe, they quite literally make everything in our universe. The only thing it doesn't make is empty space. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's best to have a discussion, which is chapter one in my quantum mechanics book.
Yeah.
It comes right after introducing the terms we introduced last time, which is odd numbers are bosons, even numbers are photons, equilateral energies form squared numbers, things like that. We've had that discussion in the previous talk. So chapter one, as I call it, in my ebook on quantum mechanics, delves into the basics of this so that you can begin to understand in a natural sense, an intuitive way, the difference between mass and matter. So when somebody says, uses the term matter in physics and uses the term mass, you'll immediately know what they should be talking about. And if the two terms don't line up with the mental picture, you know immediately to either correct them or that they haven't understood physics themselves. Because this mixing of mass and matter comes up quite often in physics.
Yeah. Okay, so let's make a separate session on the fundamentals of the dimensions then. Now we have a place that it does play a role and it does need to be understood.
It does.
And so having gotten that in our mind and in the picture, can you play with the idea of unfolding how tetrionics and the universe step up and how people can follow that idea, say, in the broad brush line of the universe being composed of tetrions?
Right. I'll cover the spatial coordinates here in the time we have left, the next 15 minutes.
Okay.
And people listening to this quick discussion, I encourage you to download the QM, Tetrionics QM book, the first one, and go to the Tetrionics 101, will be the first one we discuss, and we'll work through the sections, and I'll tell you, so you can have it in front as I describe it, because just listening won't convey it. The old picture's worth a thousand words applies here. But once you get your head around the basics of this, even you will know more than Einstein and everyone before him as to why you don't have space-time, why it is space and time. They're separate issues and they're important to describe, and you'll even know what the C squared in E equals MC squared is all about. Whereas if you ask a physicist today to explain what the C squared is, they'll generally say it's just a big number. Which is not really a scientific answer at all.
Yeah.
So here we go. Starting off with Tetrionics 101. It's a illustration titled Free Space. By that I mean, if you were to take all the energy out of the universe, remembering that energy forms mass and matter, and it also forms electromagnetic fields that interact to give us force, if you were to remove all the matter, all the energy in all its forms out of the universe, what would be left is empty space. And that's what this picture here is showing. You can then take a region of this empty universe and you can try to define it. The way it's normally defined in Newtonian times, it was defined with time. 1 second distance from a point, 2 seconds of distance from a point in radial circles. When relativity came along, Einstein said that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. So we'll use the speed of light traveling at 300 million kilometers per second as a benchmark, because nothing can go faster than that. And that will give us, after 1 second, say light traveling for 1 second, or a light second, will travel a certain distance. If we do it in a couple directions, we can form a certain geometry that we can use to map out space. Bearing in mind, you couldn't physically do it if you had no energy, because you wouldn't have light to shine at the speed of light. But this is an extension of one of Einstein's thought experiments. So we can do it on paper. So we have empty space, devoid of everything. There's no energy in it. There's no matter, no stars, no people, no consciousness. And we decide to make a box. We make a cubic region of space simply by having something in three axes, X, Y, and Z. So we can take the X, Y, and Z axes. We can define the coordinate system as you see there. And we then have a volume of space, three-dimensional volume, which again still has nothing in it. Now, this is where we begin to discuss mass and matter. Three-dimensional space has the X and Y components. The Z component gives volume, and that's what makes three dimensions. It's the same as it's always been defined in physics. If something didn't have the Z component, it would be called planar or Euclidean geometry. In this case, you can see it on the bottom of the box. It's just listed as being a planar Euclidean geometry. Without the Z component, there's only two dimensions, X and Y, and that's the same as a sheet of paper. And if you were to cut that sheet of paper into an equilateral triangle, you would then have a measure of mass, or mass energy precisely, depending whether you had a time measurement with it. Moving on to the next one, the mapping of space and time, we then have a picture of Planck's constant and photons of energy. And what we do is we combine Newtonian ideas with relativistic ideas, the speed of light being a limit, and time. And what we do is we pick a central point in space, and we release a photon of energy. If we release the photon of energy, it will travel in two directions. In 1 second, it will have traveled c meters, forwards and backwards, or left to the right. C times c is c squared, as in Einstein's E equals mc squared formulation. Of course, if we had just a electrostatic charge, just a boson, as you see on the left-hand top of that page, it would spread in one direction. It would be a force vector pointing in one direction, and that force vector would be c, or a velocity, hence the terms velocity vectors. It would be just a single arrow, c, pointing away. If we were to shine release three lots of energy in three directions, X, Y, and Z, like we did on the previous page, we can then start creating three-dimensional space. And that's what the next slide gives us.
Yeah. Can I just check in on that? Because you have now connected the photon with traveling in two directions, the boson with traveling in one direction. Is that correct?
One direction. Yes, yeah. That's correct.
But you haven't mentioned anything traveling in three directions, because you started by reducing the volume to a plane.
Yes.
And just thinking from the term of how many people look at a photon, they would assume that it radiates in all directions, that's in three directions. But now basically you have given it different in nomenclature, different in naming. By saying if it travels in only one direction, we call it a boson. If it goes in two directions, it is called a photon.
It's a photon.
And
yes.
Three directions, you're not talking about that. So just...
No, we're about to.
Okay.
We're about to. just to follow on with what Otto's saying there, most people think of light as being released and spreading in all directions at once. That's not actually a photon of energy. That is actually an EM field of light, where you have many triangles, many diamonds of photons pointing in all directions outward. And then when the energy is released, all those triangles, and there could be trillions of triangles pointing outwards. I'm trying to think of an analogy, a bit like a mandarin. When you open it up and look down, it has all the segments pointing out, and they could all travel out in different directions. That's a EM field. That's the model that most people have. In reality, a photon only is a diamond piece of paper. It simply is two equilateral triangles, one positive and one negative, both pointing in opposite directions. But in a field, in a light bulb, for example, there wouldn't just be two. There would be literally millions, if not billions, of these triangles spreading out from the center, from the filament, going in both directions.
Yeah. But Calvin, I think that what you're doing now is so fundamental in unraveling why you were able to simplify the complexity, because it is this unraveling from three dimensions to two dimensions to one dimension, by actually showing that you need to start thinking, associating with the photon with the plane, and the boson with the line. That yes. is where people can then understand that they actually need to think in that different manner, because what you just mentioned now, that if it goes in three directions, actually it's a stream of interconnected photons. This is where people would normally have to make a leap which you have already taken, but which for other people might be so totally new that they wouldn't know that you have taken a leap in thinking. And by pointing out this leap on thinking, they can follow that step and immediately get the starting point where it all fits together, like it did for you. Can I just ask, when you realized that the photon was planar, because for you that must have made a fundamental change.
It did. In fact, my first draft of my book, when I thought it was all finished, ready to go to the science journals, I was actually calling the tetrion the photon. Because the tetrion didn't exist. I didn't know what it was, and I could see that you could have a positive and a negative tetrion, you could have neutral tetrions, and it made sense if they had to, that it had to have mass. You couldn't have it massless, and that was the key. And over a period of 5 years, I've developed and refined and applied and re-examined my work over and over, adding details as I've discovered the relationships to get to where we are now. Now, this means that this work that I'm putting out as tetrionics, or as Principia Geometrica for the whole set, really is a whole new science text. This is no different than E.T. landing on the planet and saying, here's our university books. It requires that a lot of the things that you've been taught in the way of bosons being little round balls and photons being the same are not that. You have to take some of the English words and some of the math and retrain your brain on what the actual geometry that is at work really is. Because it is all about triangles of Planck energy momenta and regions of space. And even as a classic example, the sun, people talk about how much matter the sun has. The sun doesn't have a great deal of matter at all. It is so huge because it is full of mass, radiant triangles of energy blasting out from it. There is a small core and a small amount of mass in the way of hydrogen and helium that is being used up, but by far all the mass of the sun is in the form of electromagnetic waves rather than chunks of matter. But you'll get more familiar with mentally differentiating, as I say, between differentiating and discerning, the two D's. Between mass and matter, the two M's. I always use, and I mean always, even at the start of sentences, lowercase m for mass, capital M's for matter. And it's very important that there's little rules that I've put in. I've tried not to put too many in, but some were forcibly had to be put into the schema of things in order to get things straight and to correct many centuries of ignorance over properties such as mass and matter and what space is and things like that. And this next slide that we were talking when Otto came in to elaborate is exactly the point in case. Tetrionics 103, spatial coordinates, has got four shapes on it. And it's all about spatial geometry, or the geometry of empty space itself. As we've already discussed, one Planck quanta, a boson, because it's flat and it has charge, so it must be a boson. It's also any odd number, because the odd numbers will always have a charge associated with them. Always travel in a vector direction. The linear momenta within the odd-numbered quanta will always add up to give you a vector direction of C or V more generically. But in the case of energy in free space, it will travel at C. So this spatial coordinate diagram is now going to unite Newtonian time and relativity spatial coordinate systems, which physics today, especially relativity theory, don't understand what they mean. We've already spoken that photons travel in two directions at once because they're made up of two bosons, a plus and a minus. If, for example, they weren't a plus and a minus and they were two negatives or two positives, instead of a photon, you would have an electrostatic field, like what makes your hands stand up on your, the hair stand up on your hand or on your head. That's the only difference. They're both photons, but one's got charge, the other is neutral. But
can
that aside,
that a bit, because you're talking about the two directions and the opposite direction, basically. And so when it is in two directions, there is an expansion from that core point, which then is what
from
the photon where,
from
represents.
The middle, the very middle of the diamond will be what's called the null point, or what I call a singularity. It's just like the singularities you hear of black holes, no different. Can also be called a block wall, a null point, things like that. But that's simply where the electric and the magnetic fields meet at the center, the very center of the diamond. In the case of a photon, photons are neutral, and remember they are always 2 pi for photons, so you must have a plus and a minus coming together to form this. So the two vector directions must be in opposition to each other. The positive points one direction. In the previous drawing, it's got the positive pointing towards the top of the page, and the negative pointing towards the bottom. So once this photon's created, it will spread out in two directions. Both charges, the center of it will stay where it is, but it will grow in size every second. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger every second. Now, it's two triangles or two bosons coming together, you can also have a situation instead of a plus and a minus coming together, you can have two pluses or two minuses coming together. They are still photons of energy, but the difference here is when it's neutral, it makes up an electromagnetic field, like light and radio waves. Where you have two positives or two negatives joining together, you form an electrostatic field. And it has the same sort of properties, except what you find is, because there's two positives, that field will repel all other positive charges away from it, and it will attract all the negatives. And this is where Coulomb's law of attraction comes from. The energy momenta of the charged fields in the photons will point one way or the other. especially in the electromagnetic fields, and that's another discussion. But it's the direction of that energy momenta that creates the law of attraction, as it's known in Coulomb. I call it the law of interaction for various other reasons. But suffice to say, at this time, if you have a single Planck quanta, you can let it go and it goes in one vector direction, C. If you release a photon, or you create a photon and you release it, because there are two Planck quanta, it will go in two opposite directions, north and south, or east and west, or up and down, left and right, however you wish to term them. They spread out from that central point at the speed of light. So in 1 second, they've traveled 2 c-meters. C-meter in the positive direction and c-meters in the negative. That is the diameter of a circle. 2c is a diameter, or 2r. That's the comparison that we're making here, where r equals c, the speed of light. Using that 1 second of motion and that diameter, we can then draw a line based on that diameter to encompass a region of space, a spherical region of space. And the only thing in this spherical region of space is a photon in this case, but the area that it covers will be c squared, c in one direction by c in the other. So when you see a formula like Einstein, E equals mc squared, it's an equivalence. It is saying the energy inside any region of any c squared region of space is what we call matter, because we've taken 1 second to create this c squared to give us mass. If there was no time measurement, you couldn't create any region of space. You'd have no way of measuring how fast this block of energy moved, if at all. So you could only say you have energy. But the moment you take 1 second measurement, you create a region, which is c squared, and now you can say that the energy of 1 second has a mass. It's all equivalent. It's where people say that the sun makes its energy using Einstein's formula of E equals mc squared, they're wrong. Einstein's formula of E equals mc squared, geometrically put, is simply a triangle, or a diamond is probably the best, a diamond inside a circle. That diamond is made up of energy, and that energy is equal to a certain amount of mass. You cannot call a photon a massless particle because it has energy, and energy is equivalent to matter per to mass per second. The c squared can be related straight back to Newtonian terms. Instead of calling it c squared, you call it a second. Energy is mass seconds. So in doing that,
what you're doing now is so fundamental. It is really changing the perspective, and one of the reasons that I'd like to have you reflect on this is because also in just a short time, it would be good to start a new recording so that we don't lose quality on the recording.
I'll wrap this bit up.
Yeah,
I'm just laboring the point so that people can really focus on how important this fits in with squared geometry or equilateral geometries, but mass and matter
also
and energy.
Add to that what it meant for you, because you really had to rethink everything. Because everything you had been told turned out to be not working. And it would be helpful to add the effect of your insight as well.
Yeah, I'm heading to it.
Great.
I am, trust me. It's just one of these things where I'm being very careful to go through. Hopefully everyone's looking at the pictures as we go so that they can follow what I'm laboring on about, because it is an important thing. And what it does do, as I said earlier, is it allows you to immediately correct statements that have the word mass and matter in them and where the terms are used incorrectly. Now, we've just touched on 1 second of time will make a C squared region of space that you can measure, bearing in mind it's just a circle. It's only going in the X, plus or minus X directions to make this circle, but already we've been able to establish what Einstein's E equals MC squared really means. The other way to reshift it, obviously, is with a bit of algebra and say that mass is energy per C squared. Rearranging Einstein's equation, you get mass is energy per C squared, which is exactly as I said, it's a triangle of energy inside this circular region of space. It's planar because it's only plus and minus Z directions that it's spread out in, as per the illustration. But obviously, what we can do now, we've got a firm understanding of what mass is and how energy is related to mass. We need to know what matter is. If you look it up in physics books and textbooks and Google it if you want, or Wiki or however, the broadest description is that matter is something that has mass and possesses a volume. It displaces a region, a third component, a Z component. So how do we do that in tetrionics? We simply fire off three bosons of energy in three directions orthogonal to each other or perpendicular to each other to form the classical cube of space or Cartesian coordinates. The Cartesian coordinates have X, Y, and Z. And guess what? If you fire off three bosons or allow them to be released in those 90 degree related directions, you'll form a cube that is C to the third. You won't often find C to the third crop up. You'll see Cartesian coordinates crop up a lot, but you don't find a lot of relativity mechanics using C to the third. The one place you will find it is in the entropy formulation, or the formulation for entropy. It's there because it was in the early days, just as classical was giving way to relativity and these formulations were coming about. When you look at the formulation for entropy, you can immediately know now that the C to the third, or the C cubed, that's in that formula relates to Cartesian coordinates, which makes sense because that was the predominant form of coordinate systems used at the time. So the problem then comes about in that you'll find Hawking developed his understanding of black holes using entropy. Now, just hold that in your mind, that thought, for a second. Don't dwell on it, because now we're going to go to the next logical step. Instead of releasing three bosons of energy to go in three separate directions to make a cubic region of space, the easiest way to measure a region of space in which we want to measure the physics is just to go from a planar to a volume. And the easiest way to do that is, if you like, to square the Euclidean. Have two photons of energy, one pointing left to right, the other one pointing up and down, a bit like our earlier transverse and longitudinal waveforms. These two photons are created, or you could do the same thing with charged fields. They could be a charged field radiating just as easily as a neutral EM field. But in either case, the two photons are allowed to expand out at for 1 second. And in 1 second, they've moved plus and minus X directions, plus and minus Y directions, to give us a sphere. Not a circle like the C squared, but a sphere that has volume. They spread out and they give you C to the fourth. C to the fourth, as a spherical coordinate system, You will find in astrophysics and many other places. But as we're talking science, the place you'll find C to the fourth coordinate systems is in general relativity. When you see it in Einstein's formulation for general relativity, 8 pi g over C to the fourth, all that says is that there's 8 pi of gravity in that spherical region of space. That's it. There's nothing complex about it. Take it to your physics teacher. Ask him what C to the squared is and what C to the fourth is. Wait for their blank looks and sit them down with a piece of paper and show them just what I've shown you. Those four forms of measuring how far light travels in 1 second gives us all the geometries we need to map everything in the universe in terms of the forces that are created, in terms of energy, in terms of mass and matter. The important final takeaway points, there's two of them here. Firstly, C to the third, the Cartesian coordinates that entropy uses, when used with general relativity to explain entropy in a black hole, look at what you're doing. Geometrically, even you can see now that you're putting a square box in a ball. The coordinate systems do not match. To do the entropy breakdowns of Hawking radiation, of the decay of information in black holes, how black holes react, you have to translate from C to the third coordinate systems into C to the fourth. Otherwise, the answers you're giving are wrong. You're mixing square coordinate systems or rectilinear coordinate systems up with spherical coordinate systems. And this is where I get up on my soapbox and say, the math has led us astray. You don't understand what you're doing with the mathematics and the assumptions that you're making from those, from that poor understanding, are leading to more errors and giving us crazier results like black holes and wormholes and things like that. This is where the geometry shows its power, because on one page, we can now define empty space with no energy in it. In a 1 second region, we can add energy and define mass as being like a flat sheet of paper in a circle, a triangle in a circle for the mysticals that see it everywhere throughout the Greek literature and in the Egyptian pyramids, triangles and circles in all sorts of places. We can then take it one step further, which is the final picture on the bottom of that page in the center with the capital M, which is matter. How do we measure matter? The simplest matter is a tetrion. It's four pieces of mass energy folded up to form a tetrahedral shape that has volume. You can't measure volume in C squared. You can only measure mass, because it only measures flat sections, just like slicing through the cake. You'll only measure the mass component. You could try to measure it inside the Cartesian coordinate system, and you'll get funny things like 4 on 3 in your equations. You have things like kinetic energy and momentum, and you get the basics of it, but it complicates it, and it complicates it further down the track where you want to layer one field on top of the other to create a force. Force is simply two triangles of energy going in different directions. They'll either push when they're put on top, they push, or they repel. That's what makes the laws of attraction and repulsion. But where the easiest way to measure matter is to put it into this C to the fourth. You put a tetrahedron inside a sphere. Now, for those of you familiar with Greek geometry, circles inside triangles, circles inside squares, triangles inside circles, tetrahedra inside spheres, even Kepler's work, there's a direct connection back to what the ancients knew and what I'm showing you now. The only difference is we've had 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years worth of physical observations to put names to the things. They're no longer speculation. If the Greeks had been around today, you could magically pop one in, he'd know immediately what I'm talking about here. He'd be able to make sense of it all quite easily and readily. Instead, we're relying on the mathematics and we're confusing mass and matter. The other thing that you'll see here is that because matter has three dimensions, you cannot put it into a C-squared coordinate system because it has a Z component. Therefore, you could say photons, which are flat, diamond-shaped objects, have mass because they have energy inside the C-squared. So obviously, M equals E divided by C-squared. Photons have mass. What they don't have is matter. You can call them matterless, and you'll see it throughout my work. I call them matterless instead of massless to labor the point, but because there is no way two dimensions can have a Z component. So in summary, on that page there, you can see that a vector force is one dimensional. It's one direction, has no side direction, no orthogonal, no reverse direction. It is one-dimensional vector force. Linear momentum is a vector force. It's one-dimensional. Two dimensionals are C squared. Three dimensions, C to the C cubed, I should say, or C to the fourth. And C to the fourth is better because it encompasses light traveling in any direction. Again, back to the light bulb we were talking about, where we have a cross here of two directions just to give us our boundaries for the sphere. A light bulb would have millions of those pink arrows pointing outwards, one side of which will be positive, the other side will be negative. That is light streaming out. These terms and these concepts go on further in my cosmology work to be expanded upon for even more precise definitions of how gravity comes about, what gravity is, and its various component parts. But what we've discussed here is simply free space is the universe without energy. Add energy, you can then make mass, matter, and force of motion or forces of interaction to get the whole universe moving as we see it. Things being attracted and pushed away from each other and pulled towards others, gravity at work, magnets at work. All that comes about because of energy. And the geometry of the energy, the equilateral geometry, sets the stage for everything in the universe and how everything works. You often hear how we're made of stardust. Well, an even more precise term is we're all made up of equilateral triangles.
Wonderful. This is where, of course, we'd like to now unfold it into the particulate view to expand this, but now that you've brought the dimensions in place, can you just briefly summarize how for you it was to realize that you actually needed to fold it down in these dimensional interpretations?
Yeah.
Because what you do now is basically reformulating the basis of what everybody's taught in school, but with a different understanding as a result of which relationships are predominant. They're the essence of the story. But that means that what you were taught and what you suddenly realized required you to switch your brain. So how does that work for you?
As I pointed out earlier, even my idea of what a photon was, as in a little ball of energy, which suddenly in my initial work I had this tetrahedral shape, my initial paper back in 2008, I think it was, even I struggled with how all this fitted together. So I applied and I worked through. Interestingly enough, the stuff that we've just touched on about C, C squared, C third cubed, C to the fourth, didn't occur to me until I'd actually written the first draft of my cosmology work. And I'd already done chemistry and electricity and all this sort of stuff. I had C squared and C to the fourth in there, but I hadn't made the connection, as we've just discussed on that one page, Tetrionics 103. It completely eluded me. And then one day I was sitting down and I had this problem. I knew from the work that I was doing with mass and matter that tetrions are empty inside, just like empty space. There's nothing inside them. So what is it that gives them their mass? Obviously, it's the energy on the four sides that give them the mass in a gravitational field, just to preface it for those that want to be pedantic about it. But that aside, I had two things. I had mass and I had matter. And I had an inkling about this matter has mass and a volume from the general wordings in physics, but there's not much more out there apart from Einstein's E equals mc squared. So I looked very closely at what I had. And what I had was a tetrion, and I had Planck's quanta. I had Einstein's formula for mass, which is energy per second or energy divided by C squared. They both translate the same. And then I had matter, which would be matter is energy per second squared. And this is an important point. You'll see acceleration, meters per second squared. Don't, whatever you do, ask your physics teacher what per second squared is or what a second squared is. You'll get the same response as you do when you ask what C squared is. What it turns out to be is 1 second is C squared, a radial measurement or radial region of space, as we've just discussed. Second squared is that squared again, and that's C to the fourth. So if you measure energy, in this case matter, it's three-dimensional tetrahedra inside a sphere, what you're actually measuring is the energy per C to the fourth, which is the same as energy per second squared. Those that have done a lot of Newtonian mechanics and physics will be starting to cotton on here that now we've not only given geometry to space, we've included time from classical Newtonian mechanics, we've defined mass and matter, but we've also explained the relationship between C squared, C to the fourth, and seconds squared in physics. All these terms are very nebulous. They're very poorly defined, even more poorly explained. It's a rote system in physics where the math tells you that the answer is per second squared. What is per second squared? Don't ask. That's just what the math tells you. We know it works because it gives us the right answers. We've done the calculations. The calculations agree with observations. And that's fine. I'm often quoted as by mathematicians in particular as wanting to tear apart math and saying that it's no good. Math is perfectly fine. What is not perfectly fine is our understanding of what is creating the math and what the math itself describes. As I've said, with C squared and C to the fourth and second squared, no physicist out there will give you a clearer answer than what I've just done. But what the important bit to take away is that I was left with this problem where I knew that the tetrahedra could only be measured in C to the fourth regions of space, spherical coordinate systems, as I call them. try to measure it in a C squared, and all I'm doing is taking a measurement that slices through it. And that's no good, because a tetrahedra is empty space inside it. All the mass, all the energy that makes it up is on the side. It's the charged fascia. So the only way around that is to carefully angle your C squareds so that they actually line up with the charged fascias, in which case, what do you have? You have a charged, equilateral charged fascia in a 1 second region, which is mass. So that confirms that if you think of it this way, you can call matter a teepee, and you can call mass the cowhide, the buffalo hide, while all teepees are made out of buffalo hides. Buffalo hides are not made out of teepees. There are conservation laws in physics where they like to interchange one from the other. Mass matter is one where they do it all the time. Energy is conserved, mass is conserved, matter is not conserved. And you'll see it throughout my work in different spots where I go to great lengths over and over to repeat that while mass is a property of matter, matter is not a property of mass. And you can do it on many levels. You can say that two dimensions is a property of three dimensions, but three dimensions is not a property of two. But by being very rigid in the coordinate systems, which developed later on, admittedly, but it upon their discovery and understanding, it opened my eyes and expanded my understanding even further, which I then condensed back down into these illustrations here. These illustrations in my work, in my ebooks, I could literally spend an hour discussing each slide and continue for the rest of my life explaining what is in that slide, the additional details, and the things that come out of it. It's a university course for each of these ebooks, because it's giving you a tangible physical geometry. That geometry is a grammar. Up until now, you've often heard that maths is the language of science. Maths cannot tell you, or cannot give you, a relationship between mass and matter. It will give you certain numbers and certain verbal descriptions, as you'll find in the text currently, but it cannot lay down the laws like geometry can. And for that reason, I often add on to the end of the statement, maths. I say, if math is the language of science, geometry is its grammar. If you cannot do something with the equilateral triangles by physically shifting them and moving them, you should not follow any math that says that you can, because you'll only be talking gibberish. The math operation may be perfectly legitimate mathematically, but it will have no basis in the reality of physics. Hence why black holes are not right. Singularities exist, but black holes do not, because you're attempting to do something mathematically that is not geometrically possible. And that's the golden guiding rule in tetrionics. But now that you can see the difference between 1 second or a C squared planar region and how it must be a flat region, you can see that when you hear the word mass, you think of a flat equilateral triangle. Doesn't matter how big or how small, any quantity of mass will be a flat equilateral triangle, or a whole series of them forming an even bigger triangle of energy, or mass energy if you like. Where you hear matter, from now on your mind should immediately think a tetrahedron, something that has sides to it but nothing inside it. And that tetrahedron, in order to be measured in a region of space, must be measured in a sphere, or can be measured in a cube if you like, but you're just complicating your own math in that case. You would use C to the fourth, or quaternion if you like, C, to create a sphere around this tetrahedron, and what you're then measuring is the matter content. So the matter content would be E divided by C to the fourth. And I'll summarize with one interesting statement here, and this is one that will absolutely shatter and blow your mind away. Everybody knows E equals mc squared. We've just been through various aspects of it. It's not complete. And why do I say this? Because it's a basic algebra formula. If we have E equals mc squared, it begs the question mathematically, what is m divided by c squared? M by c squared is energy. M divided by c squared is what? It's an open question. I've posted it. I've put it out there for public comment to anyone and all and sundry. And every time I've had to explain it. Looking at the geometry I've just given you there, you know immediately that mass is energy per c squared, as we've just discussed. So if we were to take the same thing and say, instead of energy per, how do I explain it clearly for you? If we take the c squared of energy, and which is mc squared, and divide it by c squared again, we get another form of energy. The answer is still energy. And the crazy part about it, and this is where the mathematicians and physicists struggle, you have E equals mc squared. So if you were to divide that again, you have m equals E per c squared. Divided by c squared, you have something equals E divided by C4. Energy is energy. So in this case, energy divided by C4 would be matter. So you have an unfortunate situation where Einstein gave us a mass energy equivalence, E equals mc squared, but didn't do the other half of the equation. The geometry shows us what the other half of the equation is. And that is that matter is energy divided by C4, or energy per second squared. There's a lot more connotations that come about there with acceleration work and things like that that are in the QED and gravitational books. Not enough time to discuss them right now. But again, just within this topic, we've corrected mass, matter, explained empty space, the coordinate systems of empty space that are filled by energy to give us mass, matter, and all the forces. And we've also shown that Einstein's E equals mc squared is an incomplete formulation. It's like doing, and this applies to all physicists and mathematicians since Einstein, it's like writing out the basic equation and then not bothering to do the symmetrical half. If something's multiplied by y, what is that same something divided by y? It seems to have been completely ignored, just like equilateral geometries and squared numbers. So tetrionics is full of all these little quirks, if you like. It's all part of the relearning process. But it's an important process. Too many people want to jump into chemistry or into how gravity works without understanding these subtle, important foundational points. If you take the time to work through the books in the order that they've been printed and published, and by all means ask questions, I'm here to answer questions. There are many people out there slowly getting their head around it. The more questions you ask, the more it shows to me that you're learning. And your brain is slowly re-educating itself to these, to the true reality of how the universe works. And once you do, you'll have a light bulb moment where you will suddenly pick up a text that has baffled you for years, that your teachers couldn't explain. And you'll see the answer right there in your head, based on triangles with circles around them.
That's very wonderful. Can I suggest that we close down this recording?
Okay.
In which we have put so many things together so that we can start a new recording for how it all connects up in materializing the universe. Because when I suggested that a brief introduction of the dimensions would probably be helpful.
it certainly is. It is.
Now see how that unfolded to basically putting the whole format for coming to a different framework for understanding, and a different framework of using the mind, but also using mathematics and using the equations in it. And so thank you very much for putting all that together, because I do think that without this clearly in place, the artistry of juggling the pieces of the puzzle of the tetrions to have them fall in place to form the universe will be different, because even difficult, because it will not show how it extend upon the underlying pattern which you have now unfolded. So thank you very much for that.
Not a problem.
I suggest that at this point I end this recording and I come back to you.
Okay, no problems
at all. Thank you, Calvin.